So lying flat on your back, feet slightly apart, hands a little bit away from the body with the palms facing upward. Letting go of any external distractions. Simply allowing your awareness to descend into the body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. In particular, becoming aware of the sensations where your body is touching the mat, the floor. And bringing the awareness to the area of the face, softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. Forehead open and spacious. And all the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. Simply allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with every out-breath. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. Letting go of all of these things and simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. And simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Maintaining that ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. If you find you become distracted, remember, relax, release the distraction, and very gently return to focusing on the breath. If you find that you're simply becoming dull and spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus on the breath. So relaxing and releasing any distractions on each out-breath, and arousing and refreshing your focus on each in-breath to help balance the mind. And then in conclusion, we can dedicate the positive potential that we've gathered through our time together here today towards the goal of developing and cultivating a more stable and clear mind. And on that basis, developing and cultivating the two wings of practice of wisdom and compassion. So that we can not only overcome our own problems and suffering and find genuine happiness, but so that we can help those around us also to overcome their suffering and find genuine happiness. And then it's often quite traditional as part of a dedication to recite a dedication prayer. So while I recite a dedication prayer from great Indian master Shantideva, you might like to reflect on the words of the prayer. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. And whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain, to dispel the miseries of the world. if you're meditating in the corpse posture, to finish, it's very good to slowly roll over onto your right side. And then use both of your hands to then slowly help you to sit up. Okay, then we can get back in the chairs and... Oh, no. That was so good. Now, if we want our meditation to be effective, one thing we need to do is to have an integrated approach. And one way of presenting an integrated approach is to talk about three elements: view, meditation, conduct. Here, what we're talking about is philosophical view. So we see these days now mindfulness has become very popular, which is a good thing. But sometimes, unfortunately, some of the modern day systems of introducing mindfulness don't have this integrated approach. They often just present mindfulness barely on its own, and then it, unfortunately, it loses a lot of its efficacy, its power, because there's no framework for the mindfulness. And in fact, in some cases, it could actually just amplify our dysfunctional behavior because we're more focused on making more money and more greed and so forth. So if we really want meditation and particularly mindfulness to be effective, we need to have an integrated approach. And one element within that integration from a Buddhist perspective is essential is view, or philosophical view, our world view. We need to have a healthy world view as a basis or a framework for meditation in general. So here, just to talk about a few elements of what a philosophical view might look like from a Buddhist perspective, we can talk about four aspects or four types of or parts of the philosophical view. The first one we looked at already, the idea of impermanence. So, again, I think we all have that, at least at intellectual level, as part of our worldview, that things are changing moment by moment. But what we can see here is that if we have just that philosophical view, but we don't integrate that with meditation, meaning if we don't internalize that, then it's not really going to be effective in our life. It's not going to have any good impact. So, therefore, as a basis, we can have these philosophical views, but then, of course, we need to integrate that with meditation in terms of coming to realize this experientially, this philosophical view, and then on that basis, then, that can affect our daily life conduct. So another aspect of philosophical view that is very important is to come to understand and realize this thing called dukkha in Sanskrit. This is the Buddhist description of the state we find ourselves in now. It's the first of the Four Noble Truths, the very foundation teachings of the Buddha. You know, he was prescribing, or he was indicating, what state do we find ourselves in now? And often this first noble truth, the original Sanskrit word being dukkha, often, unfortunately, it's been translated into English as suffering. And so then part of the philosophical view of Buddhism is that you hear that, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering. And then we hear that, we go, ooh, that doesn't sound right. You know, sometimes I have nice experience, pleasant experiences, so I don't like that Buddhist philosophical view of suffering. But again, here what we need to realize is a bit of a terminology difficulty. Because what the Buddha was saying is that our human condition is actually dukkha. Very hard to translate this into English. It's a very broad term. Part of the understanding of that is, in fact, that, yes, sometimes in the human life, we do actually have suffering, as we know, some sort of unpleasant physical and mental experience. That is part of the human condition. I think we all appreciate that, and that's all something that we understand is not very satisfactory. But also part of understanding what dukkha means is that part of the human condition is that we also have pleasant experiences, but those pleasant experiences, of course, are very transient, temporary, stimulus-based experiences, and that they will never fully satisfy us. So that's also part of the human condition, that even our pleasant experiences are unsatisfactory because they don't last and they're stimulus-based. But at the deepest level, to understand the human condition of dukkha, the Buddhists use this what's called all-pervasive dukkha, meaning that the human condition is such that there's always a potential for some sort of suffering to arise in our lives. Why? Because our minds are contaminated by mental afflictions. So as long as there's anger, jealousy, craving, fear, anxiety, as long as these things are in our mind, we're stuck. We're in this unsatisfactory state of dukkha. So sometimes this word dukkha is translated as unsatisfactory. So if we can appreciate this as part of our philosophical view, the implication of this is that we're going to stop looking out there for some sort of lasting happiness, because we'll understand from this that there is no lasting, genuine happiness to be found out there. So by having this as part of our philosophical view, that will help us to turn our attention inwards to understand that the real source of happiness and suffering is within our own mind. And then on that basis, there are two more parts of philosophical view. The third aspect is to understand that there's no self. Self here means overinflated false sense of me. So now we tend to see ourselves existing in a way more solid than we really are. We overinflate the sense of me, and this false sense of me, this overinflated sense of me, is called self. So this false sense of me leads to relating to things in a distorted way, and actually leads to a lot of mental afflictions such as attachment, aversion, and so forth. So if we can realize there's no self, that's going to help reduce a lot of problems in our life, a lot of mental afflictions. Of course, here we're not saying there's no me. There's no Buddhist view that says there's no me, no person. We're just saying that how we see ourselves existing is false now. We overinflate the sense of me. We believe that there's this self. At a deeper level, the part of the philosophical view is this idea of emptiness, meaning to come to appreciate and realize there is no independent me, no independent objective world out there. That in fact, that there's no subject-object duality. That emptiness actually implies everything is interdependent. So again, I think a number of us have some idea based on what we see in science these days, that things are actually interdependent. So we have some vague idea about that. So this philosophical view in Buddhism is really to appreciate what that really means at a very subtle level, that everything is interdependent. So then if we want really to our meditation practice to be effective, then the view part of the integration is we need to come to understand these ideas, not just intellectually, but then integrate with meditation to come to realize these things. Then things, we can have a big transformation in our mind and our life. And then, of course, in meditation itself, if we don't do meditation and we only have this philosophical view intellectually, we could be the smartest person in the world, but we're not going to have much change in our life. Because again, our conduct is driven by our instinctive habits. And to change our instinctive habits, we need to understand the correct, better habits and then work on them, making them a habit. This only becomes a habit through meditation and through conduct in daily life. So if we want to really change our habits, we need to bring that into experience and then integrate into our conduct in daily life. Because again, if we simply try to bring this into experience through meditation, but then in daily life our conduct is opposite to that, it's going to work against it. So if our conduct is simply driving through our old behaviours, our old habits, that's going to work against anything we do here. So we need to make sure all three are integrated. So in terms of the meditation then, we've looked at a little bit of that today. And so I think we can leave the meditation aspect where we are now. And I just want to talk a little bit about the conduct part here. So in terms of, again, if we don't integrate our daily life conduct with our view and meditation, then our current way of behaving, our current conduct, involves a lot of not very productive habits and behaviours, is actually going to work against our philosophical view and any meditation we do. So we need to make sure that our daily life conduct is in line with our view and meditation practice. And so there's a couple of elements there that particularly we need to focus on. The first is ethics, is to have an ethical lifestyle. Because actually, when we look at the philosophical view, particularly at the deepest level, this idea of emptiness, that everything's interdependent, then from that, we can understand that ethics is actually the only sensible thing to adopt as a behaviour, as a conduct. But what we really need to do, of course, also is to really make sure that ethics is the basis of all of our daily life conduct. In the Buddhist system, then, in the core practices, then ethics is the foundation. And I think ethics is the foundation of any sort of meaningful life. So we really need to be ethical in terms of avoiding harmful actions, and on top of that, trying to engage in virtuous actions as much as we can. Another part of conduct is to simplify our life, because if we don't simplify our life, we're not going to have any time for any of this anyway, because now our lives are very busy, so we need to make sure that we have good priorities in our life. So often we hear about simplifying our life. Then often what people do, of course, is they forcibly cut things out of their life. And then it's always a battle because they're still wanting to do that and they're trying to push them out of the life. So to simplify life, then it's helpful also then with the integrated approach, we can go back particularly to the view of dukkha, because if we can really work on that, it's going to be much more easy to simplify our life, because we're going to see through that view and meditation that actually a lot of things that we spend time in our life is not bringing us anything. So, and in particular here also as part of that is to reflect on our precious life and death, to really see we've got this precious opportunity, we don't want to waste it, and it's not going to last forever. So if we really reflect on these things, we're going to find that we're going to have time to meditate and work on our philosophical view and so forth. And this sometimes people really have spontaneously, particularly people who've had the so-called near-death experiences, because they've directly seen death, often when they come out of that, they really appreciate what life means and how precious it is. And so often they're spontaneously, they just do not want to waste a moment of their life anymore on meaningless things. In fact, recently I saw a little thing on the internet. This lady, she had, I think, had some terminal cancer or something like that. And She only had months to live, and she was pleading to people not to waste their life on meaningless things. You know, that really, we don't know how long we're going to live, so please don't waste your life. She was pleading to people not to do that. And so we don't need to have a near-death experience or terminal cancer. All we need to do is reflect on the fact of our precious life, and it's not going to last forever. And we can also have that prioritizing our life and really wanting to make our life meaningful. And related to that point, there's a very important point that I think sometimes people really don't look at in a very good way. And that is, what about our career? Because often people feel like there's a sort of choice. Either I do the career thing or I do the spiritual thing, which one is it? And then so when people sort of get into the idea, I have to make my life more meaningful, they think, okay, I have to throw out my career and I'll do the spiritual thing. I'll just sort of go off and sit in a cave somewhere for the rest of my life. So I think if this is our thinking, we're going to have a lot of difficulties. It's not going to work. Because if we give up our career, then how are we going to support ourselves? And also if our career is something that we're good at, that's our talent, how are we going to benefit the society, if we've given up the one thing that we're good at? So rather than thinking that it's a choice, I have to do career or spiritual, we need to be really looking again at integration, is to integrate the two, is see how we can use our talents in a more meaningful way to benefit the society. So therefore, I think it's not a choice career versus spiritual life, but we need to integrate the two. And then the last point on conduct that I tend to seem to emphasize more and more and more is the idea of sangha, of spiritual community. Because if we really want to develop our philosophical view, if we want to meditate, if we want to change our conduct, the reality is that now we have a lot of bad habits. We're easily influenced by things around us and people around us. And if we sort of try and do this on our own, my experience and experience of many people I talk to, it's almost impossible. When I first came into Buddhism many years ago, I did a couple of courses. I was very enthusiastic. I was going back to Australia and I was going to change my life. But where I went back to, there was no centres, no sangha, no one interested in doing this. And no matter how much I wanted to meditate and change my life, for 2 years, nothing changed. Nothing changed. Nothing changed. Because I just got swept up in my old habits. Because too easily influenced, too easy, it was only when I managed to extract myself out of there and I found myself with some sangha, spiritual community, that I actually had some support and I could start to make some changes. Of course, if we're advanced in our practice, actually it's the opposite. If we're advanced in the practice, spiritual community around us can be a bit of a problem or obstacle, because at a high level, the only way we're going to advance is if people test us. So we need people testing us. We need people irritating us, annoying us, and testing us. In spiritual community, in theory, that shouldn't be happening. They should be supportive. And so if everyone's nice and kind to us, how are we going to develop patience? Impossible. So you find in the text, high advanced practitioners go deliberately into situations like that where people are testing them. Like a classic story was Lama Atisha, great Indian master who came to Tibet to reintroduce Buddhism to Tibet. He brought an attendant with him from India who was completely obnoxious. And then the Tibetans said, "Why have you got this person? Get a person that's helpful." And the Lama Atisha told the Tibetans, "He's my most holy teacher. He specifically picked that person so that he would test him." So, of course, at our level, maybe we don't need that. So at our level, we need supportive sangha. We need supporting sangha. So this is something I can't overemphasize enough from my own experience and speaking to many people. So, you know, you've got the group here. So it's great that you have this opportunity to meet together regularly, to do some study together, to meditate together. Because really, my experience and many people without that as a beginner, almost impossible to go anywhere. Because we're just swept away by habits and other things and other people. So I can't overemphasize the need for Sangha. Does it have to be a Buddhist center? No, but at least like-minded people and meet together regularly, discuss things, meditate together. Otherwise, I think it's going to be almost impossible. So this, I think, is very essential. So these are some elements of integration if we really want to have some change in our life. And then just very briefly, a few points before we wrap up in terms of how to structure the day in a good way. Of course, a key to progress is continuity. Continuity means not only to have a daily meditation practice, but to continue to cultivate what we meditate on in daily life. Now, in terms of a daily meditation practice, then it's recommended to do it at the same time each day, because one of the most difficult things is just to develop the habit. So if we keep changing the time we meditate, we're not really developing a habit. And generally, it's recommended to meditate first thing in the morning, because usually that's when we're most fresh, most quiet where we live. And also, of course, it's a good way to start the day. And we can sort of usually commit to a certain time early in the morning. Whereas if we decide we want to do our meditation practice in the evening, for example, for most of us, that could be difficult. Social engagements, tired from work, many reasons to not do it in the evening. And also with meditation practice, very much recommended the phrase quality over quantity. Particularly in the shamatha practice, much better to meditate for 15 or 20 minutes in a focused way than simply sit there for an hour getting caught up in dullness and distraction. So quality over quantity. If you want to meditate longer but you can't maintain the focus, then break up, say, your 45 minutes into two 20-minute sessions with a little two-minute break in the middle. Also very helpful to meditate the same amount of time, to set a timer. Have a little timer that goes off, you know, one of these little apps that go off after 15 or 20 minutes. Because if we don't have that, what often happens is on days when things are a little bit going difficult, things are not going well, after 5 or 10 minutes we go, oh, too difficult, I'll stop. And this is not good, because one of the things we definitely need to cultivate in the spiritual path is perseverance. And if we give up every time when things get a bit difficult, we're not developing any perseverance. Very important. Also, on days when things are going well, if we don't have a timer, what will happen, of course, is, oh, things are going really nice today, I'll just keep going. And so what do? We keep going until when? Until it starts to go not so good. And so then we finish. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending in dullness and distraction and agitation, that's what we remember, we associate with meditation. We're not going to want to meditate again. Whereas if things are going well, the alarm goes off, we stop, that's what we remember, we'll be enthusiastic, we'll want to meditate again the following day. And so, of course, also with the meditation, we need to make sure we have good conditions where we meditate. So ideally, if you have the luxury of a spare room you can set aside for meditation, fantastic. Maybe you won't have that. At least set aside a corner of your room for meditation and make it comfortable, clean and inviting. And also with that meditation, when you're meditating, make sure the environmental conditions are okay. Not too hot or not too cold. Too hot, you're going to get sleepy. Too cold, maybe get agitated. Also, you can adjust the lighting, you know. Maybe if it's too light, you get agitated. Too dark, you get sleepy. So that's something we can adjust. Also, of course, important, very important with meditation, make sure we get enough sleep. Unfortunately, in many of our modern society, sleep deprivation, big issue. Not going to work with meditation. So make sure we get enough sleep. Otherwise, dullness will surely set in. Also, diet, very important. Unfortunately, our modern diets are very poor, particularly in most of societies now. Overload of sugar, creates a lot of ADHD, a lot of agitation, so healthy diet, very important. And then to bring the meditation into the day, particularly if we're engaging in a lot of this shamatha practice, the developing our mindfulness, then we need to bring that mindfulness into the day. So again, at the beginning of the day, we can simply say, okay, I'm going to be as mindful as possible throughout the day. And then probably a few minutes later, we'll forget that and we won't be mindful. So here, what can be helpful is to use triggers to, and triggers can take on a number of forms. One form is pick a couple of activities that you do every day, simple activities, and always make a conscious effort to be mindful in those activities. Things like brushing the teeth. I mean, normally in the morning we're in a hurry, we're running late for work, brushing teeth quickly, thinking about all the things we have to do, rush out the door and go, did I brush my teeth this morning? We don't even remember that. So, for example, when you brush the teeth, don't be brushing your teeth and thinking about all the things you have to do that day. When you're brushing the teeth, be aware of the sensations on the gums and all the things that go together with that. Another classic example is eating meals. Again, we're usually gulping down the food and thinking about all sorts of things. Whereas if we're actually present with eating the meal, we're going to actually enjoy the meal more as well. So there's a win-win situation. Also, we can use modern technology to help us. There are many apps now that can help us with this. Like one simple one is called Mindfulness Bell. You program it and it'll automatically go off on regular intervals, every half hour, hour, 2 hours, whatever you program. And when it goes off, then you stop whatever you do and then do a little mindfulness exercise. Maybe simply is focusing on your breath for 3 breaths. And when you do that, you'll be surprised how just a little thing like that at regular intervals through the day starts to get us in a more mindful state of mind. So use the technology for a good purpose rather than as a distraction. And then at the end of the day, I think also it's good to finish the day on a good note. A couple of things we can do there. One, of course, is if we have time and energy and want to do another meditation in the evening, fantastic. At least what we can do is 2 things. First is at the end of the day, before we go to sleep, is review our day. How did our day go? And there we can do 2 things. Any negative things we've done, we can look at that. And again, maybe don't pick all of them, but maybe say pick the top 3 negative things you did during the day. And then with each of those, we can go through a little bit what's called purification from a Buddhist perspective. First thing is to have sincere regret for doing that. Then reaffirm the positive direction you want to follow your life. Then think of some practical remedy. For example, if you verbally abuse someone at work, you might think, okay, tomorrow I'm going to apologize to them. And the 4th point is to make a strong determination not to do that the following day. So if we do those 4 things with maybe the top 3 negative things, it's a good way of weakening the habit and purifying our mind of those negative habits. Equally important is to focus on the good things we did during the day. Because unfortunately in our modern society, we seem to always focus on the negative and we beat ourselves up, low self-esteem. Very important to focus on the positive. So likewise, pick the top 3 positive things you did during the day and 2 things. First, rejoice in having done that. And second, make a strong determination to continue to do that the following day. That's going to strengthen our positive habit and also end up with a balanced view of ourselves instead of an imbalanced view, thinking I'm just hopeless and I always just do negative things. So that's one thing we can do at the end of the day, a day's review. The second thing we can do is what we did a little bit just at the beginning of the session, shavasana. So go to bed, lie in your bed, on your back, flat on your back, and do a little mindfulness exercise. Just simply noticing sensations throughout the body. And you do that as long as you can maintain some alertness. Maybe it's only after a couple of minutes, maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And then that's a mindfulness practice. So that's a shamatha practice. And also it's a way of releasing any tension from the day, physical and mental tension. And it's a good transition to sleep. So then once you've done that, you start to get a bit sleepy. Then mentally note, okay, my meditation's finished. And then move out of that posture into your normal sleeping posture. So therefore, it's a way to release tension from the day. It's a mindfulness exercise, and it's a good transition into sleep. So that we can all do, I think. That's quite comfortable. So that's how we can end the day on a good note. So that's all I wanted to mention about how to maybe program our day in a good way. Anyone have any questions, last questions before we wrap up today about anything we've covered today? Nope. All quiet. Stunned silence. Okay. Okay, then just two things and then I'll finish. First is, today we looked at basics of meditation. In particular, we focused on the stabilizing meditation, the shamatha practice. And again, I think it's very important for us as beginners to emphasize that practice. And if we want to get into that practice more, then I can thoroughly recommend a book called Attention Revolution by Alan Wallace, and it's all about the shamatha practice, and he talks about the breath, the mind, and the awareness practices in a very clear, methodical way. So I think this is a good place to start, and also in this book he talks about the compassion wing of the practice as well. Also, I have my own website. GlennSvensson.org, where I have also a lot of audio from other courses that I've run, and I've run a number of different retreats as well. I have also lots of charts and other material on there, so whatever you find on the website, just help yourself. And also I have a contact page on there, so if you want to ask me any questions at any time, you can just send me a message and I'll try and answer that. So that's all I wanted to say today, and so just to finish, I'd like to thank the Yeshi Buddhist group team who've looked after me very well over the weekend and for putting on this event. And then I'd like to thank all of you for coming along here, taking the time, getting through, fording the rivers to get here today. And I hope that you got something out of today, and I hope to be back again sometime in the not too distant future. So thank you very much. Yeah.